This is Talking Books
on RNIB Connect Radio.
Today marks exactly 81 years since the first Talking Book was sent to a blind listener. So today, let's explore the history of the service and the man behind it, and travel to some of the locations involved. This is the story of Ian Fraser and the first Talking Books.
Machines which will read aloud to the blind, books recorded on discs of the gramophone pattern, are being manufactured and will be available in the early autumn.
So it was here that the first ever Talking Books were recorded.
Talking Books was very much a project that Fraser himself drove forward.
This is how I enjoy the Talking Book. Every night, at about 10 o'clock, I shoot the wife off to bed, then make up the fire, draw my armchair near, and after having got a bottle of Worthington and a cigarette going, I switch on the Talking Book. Don't you think this is real luxury?
The Talking Book service from RNIB is 80 years old. In that time, it's gone from a service that started with three books in its library, each having been recorded to wax, to a digital service that you can get on CD, USB, or download to your smart device.
Recording was done mechanically, the speaker's voice being received by a trumpet, down which the sound waves travelled to a diaphragm, making it vibrate.
The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie.
Henry Esmond by William Makepeace Thackeray.
They were the two earliest books recorded, but I can't determine which one actually was first.
Thanks to some detective work by audiobook historian Matthew Rubery, some digging in the archives of Blind Veterans UK and RNIB, and with some newly discovered voices from the past, we can paint an audio picture of one man who was desperate for technology to catch up with his vision. A simple one, to make a book that could talk.
Cranford by Elizabeth Gaskell. Recorded for the Talking Book Library for the Blind. Read by Anthony MacDonald. Chapter 1, Our Society.
A clip from one of the oldest surviving talking books, narrated by the first person to read for the service, Anthony MacDonald, and recorded in what Ian Fraser described as a hut in my own garden. But who was Ian Fraser? And why was he so determined and driven to provide a service which would bring literature to the blind, would bring back the simple pleasure of reading a book? We'll start looking for answers to that question in the basement archives of Blind Veterans UK with Information and Archives Officer Rob Baker. But first, a very quick note on names. The charity Blind Veterans UK was known at the time as St Dunstan's, and RNIB, the Royal National Institute of Blind People, having not yet received its royal charter, was simply known as NIB, not RNIB. You'll hear them referred to by both names, but as we'll be looking at contemporary material from the 1920s and the 1930s, and to avoid some confusion, by default we'll always try to refer to them by their older names. And it's important to note that it was a joint effort between NIB and St Dunstan's, with some help from America and the American Foundation of the Blind. But the service, which would eventually provide over 80 million books for blind and partially sighted readers, started with one man.
I find it cooler here, which is one thing
as well, as also, of course, it should be. Something up the trolley. So
my name is Rob Baker. I'm the archivist for the charity Blind Veterans UK, formerly known as St Dunstan's, and we are in the archives at the headquarters of Blind Veterans UK in Harcourt Street in London. kind of these go back to, yeah, certainly 34. There's a lot of kind of initial correspondence. And Ian Fraser, later Lord Fraser, came to what was then St Dunstan's, having been blinded at the Battle of the Somme in 1916.
Nearly 2 months had passed since July the 23rd, 1916, the day when I'd last seen the world. I'd spent that morning in charge of a burial party, finding a last resting place for some of those who would not grow old as we that are left have grown old. We'd fought in the afternoon when I was knocked out by a bullet in the head. I'm not sure if I lost consciousness, but I remember being bandaged up. I know I walked to the field dressing station and talked to my company commander on the way down to the line. I took it for granted that I would soon be all right. I didn't draw any sinister inference from being, temporarily, as I thought, unable to see.
Talking Books narrator Robin Holmes reading from My Story of St Dunstan's by Ian Fraser, who was to become Sir Ian Fraser and eventually Lord Fraser of Lonsdale. He wrote two autobiographies and was working on a third before his death in 1974. And in these unpublished notes, we get the only insight into his life as a young man.
So I left South Africa in 1907 when I was 10 years old. I came to England with my father, then a man with white hair and a grey beard, and he seemed to me to be a very old man. I went to a preparatory school at Eastbourne called St. Cyprian's, and then on to Marlborough College. I never attained the heights, never became a prefect or a captain, but I distinguished myself slightly in the officers' training corps, the OTC. I very soon became a sergeant, and when the war broke out in 1914, public schools were asked to nominate boys for the Royal Military College, Sandhurst.
He graduated and became a second lieutenant in the King's Shropshire Light Infantry, and after a few quick courses in signalling and scouting, he was sent to France in May of 1916. The bullet that took his sight hit him a mere 2 months later. In his first book, Whereas I Was Blind, he describes one night, many months later, in recovery in the UK.
I crept out of bed, felt my way towards the end and across the room to the dressing table. Groping about over my head, I found the electric light bulb in its glass shade. It was cold. Of course it was cold. She had put out the light when she left the room. I fumbled my way gingerly across the room to the door. I found the electric light switch and pressed it down, then back to the dressing table. The bulb was now warm. I pulled it down to my face and pressed it to my eye, or at least to the place where my eye had been. The glow was pleasant and comforting. It stimulated some nerve endings. Was that a glimmer of light? Of course it wasn't, for that eye had been removed. And the other eye? What of that? It had collapsed when the German bullet had entered my temple. I knew it would be nonsense, but I had for some weeks decided that I must do this one night when I was alone. I should have looked such a fool if anyone had come in and seen me. Looking a fool, that was the worst part of blindness, or so it seemed to me then. And they would be sorry for me. The kindest people would be sorry for me. And I was sorry for myself. My God, what a sacrifice I had made. So light-heartedly, so cheerfully. And I was so young. Only 18 when that bullet hit me. And here I was, out of the war, which I had trained for so long. Not only out of the war, but out of life.
So at only 18, Ian Fraser's world has collapsed, and he's stuck in hospital.
It was while I was in the officer's ward of No. 2 London General Hospital, still rebellious, that two things happened to me of the greatest importance. One, was the visit of a girl who wore the smoothest and most beautiful kid gloves that I had ever felt, and the other was the letter she brought with her. She was a VAD who worked at St. Dunstan's as Arthur Pearson's personal assistant and guide, and it was he who had written me the letter. The letter told me how he had gone blind in middle life, how he had made the best of it, and had found much to do to interest him, how other young officers who had been blinded before me had found useful things to do and were happy, how he had established St. Dunstan's to train blinded officers and men, and inviting me to go there. I accepted the invitation and entered a new world. The lady with the gloves. I fell in love at first sound of her. Her charm, her personality, her true sympathy. She is now my wife.
It was apparent from the beginning that he was clearly a very bright and an able young man. And our founder and first chairman, Sir Arthur Pearson, clearly identified that in the beginning from him. And before too long, he was placed in charge of our nascent aftercare department, which was responsible for the ongoing welfare and support to the blind veterans after they'd received their initial training with us. So he became very involved with us from an early stage.
The charity St. Dunstan's was named after the building in which the soldiers were housed, St. Dunstan's Lodge on Regent's Park in London. A fire in the 1930s destroyed the lodge. It was demolished in 1937 and a new villa called Winfield House was built on the site for Barbara Hutton, the daughter of the founder of Woolworths. When her marriage to the actor Cary Grant was dissolved in 1946, the mansion was presented to the United States government for use as the American ambassador's residence. So we're as close to the original location as we could get without worrying the Secret Service.
My name is Matthew Rubery. I'm a literary historian at Queen Mary, University of London. So St. Dunstan's, which was a charity for the rehabilitation of war-blinded veterans, so soldiers who came back from the First World War had lost their sight through being shot or through gas or other causes. This is where they came to retrain and rehabilitate. So the soldiers who came back from the First World War and had lost their sight were used to being quite vigorous, able-bodied men who led active, independent lives. So it was quite a change to go to the reverse. And attitudes towards blindness were a lot different at that time. So there wasn't a sense that people could do the full range of activities as they could before losing their sight. St. Dunstan's promoted a very different attitude, though, that blind people could do basically every activity that other people could do. So the typical soldier's rehabilitation would include a couple hours a day of exercise, a couple hours of reading Braille and learning to type, and other activities. Anyone who came near Regent's Park could see St. Dunstaners out exercising, either rowing on the lake or jogging or doing lots of physical activities that weren't typically associated with blindness. And I think that was partly to help the soldiers recover, but it was also partly to display how active they still were.
Sadly, our founder, Sir Arthur Pearson, died in a domestic accident at a relatively young age in 1921. And Fraser, who I think was very much being groomed to be successor, found himself, in fact, taking over whilst he himself was still aged only 24, a very young age. So he became our chairman. At that time, very much the kind of driving post, really, in the charity. And his own personality, I think, contributed to that. But an interest in technology and how technological developments could aid our blind veterans and certainly then the wider blind community also.
The wider blind community was represented by a charity once known as the British and Foreign Blind Association for improving the embossed literature of the blind and promoting their employment. Although in 1914 that name changed to the much shorter National Institute for the Blind, or even shorter, NIB. St Dunstan's was originally an offshoot of the NIB, and when we return to the story of Talking Books, we'll find out how the two charities worked together on Fraser's dream of a book that could talk. You're listening to the story of Ian Fraser and the first Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio. And we'll have more after this.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I love talking books. I don't know what my life would be without them. I love travel books. I love all the people that travel the world and tell us what they've done. It's the one freedom I really have, is to read the books that I love and people doing things in the world. You just get absolutely drawn into the story. And it's difficult to get to your bed sometimes. I think Talking Books is the best thing ever.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now a return to the story of the first Talking Books.
We had gramophones at St Dunstan's from the beginning, just as we had pianos and indoor games. You had to wind the instrument up by hand and put in a new needle after each record. And the more or less musical noises emerged from an enormous horn, shaped like a trumpet. Singers sounded hardly human. But it was possible sometimes to make out the words of their songs. It ought to be possible, I thought, to record human speech. Theoretically, it should be possible to record whole books. I took my dream to the Columbia Gramophone Company and the Pathophone Company.
Ian Fraser has a dream of a talking book, and his curiosity and interest in technology prompt him to carry out some experiments, many of which are documented in the archives of RNIB.
With regards to the general material housed by the archive, we have examples of embossed braised type going back to at least 1838. My name is Robert Saggers. I'm Heritage Services Manager. We're located in Judd Street, and we house the historical archive for RNIB. The Research Library collection, which is also part of the archive, effectively has a rare book collection of materials on blindness going back to at least 1740. We have some very old books, both in French and English, dealing with the history of blindness, which are very interesting from a sociological point of view, because you can examine how attitudes have changed enormously, radically, to blind and partially sighted people since that time. So it's a fascinating collection.
Remember that at the time I'm speaking about, there were no regular wireless broadcasts, and the blind man's world was silent as well as dark, unless there was someone to talk to him. No wonder he wished that books could talk.
There are plenty of companies which we approached, Columbia, Decca and such like, all said that they couldn't actually meet the technical requirements we asked for.
I know, that's interesting, because Fraser has said in his book, or he's mentioned all the successes he had, but it seems like there were a number of recording companies who'd said no and almost said it was impossible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Columbia Gramophone Company have written, "We are at the present moment scarcely in the position to consider making 15-minute records, as these would have to be done on the slow speed system, 33 and a third revolutions per minute. Quite frankly, for practical use, we in this country cannot feel confident in being able at present to produce a satisfactory method of reproducing such records in the home."
But the Gramophone Company said yes and they'd go ahead with it. "I acknowledge your letter of the 25th of September, confirm your recording session with your reader at our studios tomorrow, Thursday at 3 p.m. We note that two records should be made at 20 rpm and that you do not wish them to run longer than half an hour."
We experimented together. The disc was run a little slower than the normal 78 revolutions per minute and the threads were cut a little closer together. We succeeded in making a record that ran 6 minutes. And then one that lasted 10 minutes. All this was in 1919, long before anyone had heard of long-playing records or talking books.
He was already getting interested in technology and in very crude early attempts at a talking book as early as 1919. I think in his book he describes the results as vile, so they clearly weren't too successful, but it clearly... It was something that he kept in his mind.
The reproduction was vile. Recording was done mechanically, the speaker's voice being received by a trumpet, down which the sound waves travelled to a diaphragm, making it vibrate. On the diaphragm was a needle that cut the wax. You had to speak right into the trumpet to get enough force to cut the wax. And the reproduction was ruined by resonance. Yet those primitive records we made were, in fact, the first beginnings of talking books.
So one of the documents that we hold in the archive, this talks specifically about the early working together of the two charities on talking books. So the memos begins, "In order to avoid duplication, an arrangement has been come to with the National Institute for a joint experiment to be undertaken. The experiment is in progress. The total expenditure will be about £250 and St Dunstan's has agreed to pay half."
And I notice here on this document, it's one of the first mentions that America is also undertaking similar experiments.
Yes, Fraser always explained that the Americans started the research after he did, but they rushed it into production ahead of him. So his feeling was that the Americans chose a technology that wasn't the ideal form. So talking book records in the States played at the rate of 33 RPM rotations per minute. And the talking books in the UK played at 24 RPM. And that was a difference of about 9 or 10 minutes. So American records could play for about 15 minutes each side, and UK records could play about 25 minutes each side. And it doesn't sound like much today, but it made a huge difference to the budget at the time.
When we made our experiments with those early gramophone records, the results were imperfect because the idea was before its time. That time had still not come when, a few years later, I met an inventor who'd found a way to make a film talk and was trying to persuade the big companies to try it out. They all turned him down, and both the film trade and the public were derisive about the idea of moving pictures that would talk. I wondered if we might have the talking without the pictures, and I asked the inventor to make me a piece of this film. Again, the technical problems were too great for reasonable reproduction.
Ian Fraser first had the idea for making a talking book when he heard a gramophone at St. Dunstan's and thought it would be possible to record a book. But it was never certain that sound recording technology was the only way to go, and there were a lot of alternatives besides the gramophone. The gramophone wasn't even the most popular option. It was really just the most economical. So some people thought that the optophone would be used, and this is what we're looking at right now. And the optophone's basically, it looks like a flatbed scanner, and you could place a book on top of it, and five beams of light would scan the bottom of the page, and it would emit different tones depending on what the shapes of the letters were on the page. So it was often called the musical book, because instead of hearing, say, the words read aloud, you would hear a set of musical notes. And then if you were experienced enough, you could translate those musical notes back into speech. F, I, K, J, P. a woman named Mary Jameson began the first demonstrations around London trying to read a page of an ordinary book using this machine. In the first demonstration, she read at a rate of one word per minute. By comparison, an average person reads a book at a rate of 250 to 300 words per minute. So that's how difficult it was to sort of hear a word scanned, convert it into musical notes, and then have to convert it back into language to be able to read. Very few people could do it. Mary Jameson eventually got a bit better, or the technology got better too. She did become the first blind person to read an ordinary novel, Anthony Trollope's The Warden, using this device. There were two other choices. One was called the visigraph. There were lots of technologies actually being looked into, but the visigraph would be one example, that it would translate the page of any printed book into embossed lettering, and people could sort of read it the way that people read a refreshable braille display today. It wouldn't be translated into braille, it would just create the actual picture of the book under your fingertips. But again, it was very difficult to use and wasn't practical, it was expensive. And then what was by far the most popular option was called the speaking film. And it was thought that talking book technology would take place on film rather than records. And there was a real reluctance on the part of NIB and St. Dunstan's to invest too much, too heavily in the gramophone because they thought it might be obsolete in a few years. And in a way, they were right. I mean, the technology did change rapidly. But the one advantage the gramophone had over other forms of technology was that it was affordable. A lot of blind people at the time didn't even have electricity. So whereas the gramophone came in three different models, one using electricity, one that was mechanical and did not require electricity, and then one model with headphones, the speaking film player could not be used by anyone that did not have electricity. So it's just too expensive and impractical, and all these alternatives had a huge drawback in that way. So really, the gramophone, turntable technology, it wasn't the best, it wasn't the favorite, but it was made the most economic sense.
This is RNIB Connect Radio, and you're listening to Talking Books, the story of Ian Fraser and the first Talking Books, and we'll have more in a moment.
I think the whole talking book scheme, in whatever form it is absolutely fantastic.
Joanna Trollope on the RNIB Talking Book Service.
I think in this day and age, modern medicine is so clever and so sophisticated, and we spend an enormous amount of time and energy and enthusiasm saving lives. But what the talking books do, and what the RNIB, I think, does in general, is save sanities before you know you get to the end of your life. The number of people whose lives have been transformed by talking books. I mean, the number of people who are visually impaired or blind who say that their lives have been absolutely changed. This is a lifeline. It's impossible to emphasize how important that is.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
And now on RNIB Connect Radio, a return to the story of Ian Fraser and the first talking books.
Then electrical recording was introduced to the gramophone industry, and what had been a visionary ideal suddenly became a practical possibility. No longer did the speaker have to bellow down a trumpet to make a diaphragm vibrate. He spoke into a microphone, and the engineer put it onto the wax with whatever power he thought necessary. Electrical recording brought with it many other exciting possibilities, and I set up an experimental laboratory at St. Dunstan's where we could carry out some research.
So it was here at St. Dunstan's in Regent's Park that the first ever talking books were recorded. A number of tests took place here, experiments, say reading Churchill's memoirs or Kipling fiction, just to test out whether the technology would work, what the best way to read a talking book was.
By omitting the bass tones from the voice, we succeeded in cutting the threads at 200 to the inch instead of the standard 100.
gramophone records work by vibrating a stylus in the grooves. The larger amount of bass, the larger physical movement from side to side of the stylus.
This doubled the playing time of a record running at what was then the standard speed of 78 revolutions per minute. We set about lowering this speed and eventually got it down to 24 revolutions per minute. We ran into all sorts of technical problems. We had to find the right material for the records and a needle that would last the unheard-of playing time of 25 minutes.
So I'm looking at St. Dunstan's review from October 1935, just before the first talking books went out to readers. And Ian Fraser and his usually began these issues with a general update about what was new with the organization. In this one he writes, "Probably most of my friends will agree with me that being read to by a congenial person is one of the greatest of our pleasures. But this is not always possible. Professional readers are too expensive. Members of the family, kind though they may be, are busy with necessary matters in the home, and we often hesitate out of consideration to let it be known that there is some particular matter we want read to us. These thoughts prompted the idea of a mechanical reader aloud. An intensive investigation by a committee set up by St. Dunstan's and the National Institute for the Blind proved that the gramophone was the best method at present available of recording and reproducing reading aloud. We have now reached the stage when we can put about 4,000 words on one side of a 12-inch record. This means about 25 minutes reading or 50 minutes reading on a double-sided record."
The matter of cost was always a restraining factor on inventive originality. For the blind world isn't big enough itself to provide a mass market for anything. Any article that has to be specially made for such a relatively small community cannot be mass-produced, and therefore will never be cheap. The main reason we concentrated on talking records rather than talking films was that equipment for playing them was already mass-produced. It was a matter that affected the whole blind world, so we worked in cooperation with the National Institute for the Blind.
The joint committee between St. Dunstan's and NIB was called the Sound Recording Committee, with Fraser as its chairman. But at this point, we should introduce Lord Nuffield, who started life known as William Morris. He was born in 1877 and left school at 15 to become a repairer and maker of bicycles, then of motorcycles, and finally of cars. His company, Morris Motors Limited, prospered in the years after the First World War. He was one of the first British industrialists to introduce mass production methods, and he's often referred to as the Henry Ford of England. From the Morris Oxford of 1913 to the post-war Morris Minor, his Morris and MG cars were known around the world. When the Sound Recording Committee estimated that £2,200 would be needed to make the Talking Books Library a reality, it was to William Morris, or as he was known at the time, Lord Nuffield, that they turned. After an exchange of letters between Fraser and Nuffield, he decided he would donate £5,000 in a one-off gesture. That's estimated to be around £320,000 in today's money.
Although the service would have gone ahead anyway, did allow them to vastly expand more quickly that winter into making more recordings than would otherwise been possible.
With the very generous help of Lord Nuffield, we began to build up a talking book library, such as I'd dreamed of 15 years before.
The Sound Recording Committee now embarked on a process that still causes arguments to this day. What books to record and who to narrate them.
Machines which will read aloud to the blind, books recorded on discs of the gramophone pattern, are being manufactured and will be available in the early autumn. The records will form part of a circulating library of talking books. It needs little imagination to appreciate the boon to the blind and the responsibility of being the instrument for transmitting it to them. It may be thought, especially by those who habitually turn to books for gifts, that choosing would be not only pleasant but easy. But it is not so easy.
Who chose the books to be recorded, what books they chose, and then how were these books read. The initial selection committee had people like Fraser on it, but for the most part, the selection committee consisted of Oxbridge-educated, cited men of letters, who were very knowledgeable about literature, but also had a real preference for classic literature. So they were men of good taste, but they didn't necessarily represent their readers.
The initial difficulty of selection takes shape after a glance at the categories in any publisher's catalogue. Biography, children's books, classics in the wide sense, economics, essays and belles-lettres, fiction, history, poetry and drama, religion and theology, politics, science, travel. Two from each of these and the box is full.
Initially, the policy was 75% of the books had to be books of permanent value, then 25% could be ephemeral ones. So this meant most of the selections were pre-20th century titles. You could have a few bestsellers, but not too many, because it was difficult to tell whether those would be useful in a few years, whereas the other books would last and could be used every year. But this also meant that a lot of the books were difficult to read.
And in a sense, they all come under the heading of Desert Island Discs. They were originally chosen by the Sound Recording Committee, of which I was the first chairman. And before we drew up our first list, we canvassed a number of blind readers to find out what they wanted. Their lists had too little in common to help the selectors much, but they did give us some idea of what the readers did not want. One of them was particularly explicit. He ended his reply to our questions with the plea, "But no poetry and no prose." When we'd chosen our first talking books, we had the task of finding suitable persons to do the talking. The ideal voice should be exceptionally clear, for technical reasons, not too expressive, and yet not monotonous. As in reading aloud, the speaker shouldn't impose his personality between the book and the listener, nor should he over-dramatize it. On the other hand, his voice shouldn't be too flat or devoid of character portrayal. This is a pretty tall order, and we'd quite a lot of difficulty in finding the right sort of person for the job.
The first few narrators also had to have a few tricks up their sleeve. Ian Turner is a former studio manager at Talking Books, starting as an engineer in 1966.
Of course, recording on wax discs means that you have to have a one take, basically. If you make a mistake during that recording, the whole disc is just wiped clean. So you have these narrators we had then had to record for about 25 minutes without making a mistake. I remember one of our narrators called Andrew Timothy. He used to talk to us about recording on wax discs, and he was very clear about what he has to do. If he made a mistake, he didn't actually make a mistake. He just sort of covered it over and carried on recording. And one of his favourite things he used to say is that the important thing is, you say a word that you've never heard of before, say it with such conviction that people who have been saying it correctly for the last 20 years are now wondering whether they are saying it correctly.
Quickly and with confidence.
Yeah. Absolutely.
More about the first books and narrators in a moment. But before you could hear a talking book, you needed the proper equipment.
We're at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden, and we're standing before a 1935 model Decca LP player. This model is about the size of a suitcase. It's a bit smaller than some of the other models I've seen from about 10 or 12 years later. But it's not only about the size of a suitcase, it's shaped like one as well. So you have a lid on it that would buckle, and then you could carry it around by a handle to make it portable to a degree, although it's pretty bulky and heavy still. And then once you set it up, you'd lay it flat on a table, open up the lid, and there the turntable would be.
There were one or two consequences arising from this general but unacknowledged poverty, and this very much acknowledged gentility, which were not amiss, and which might be introduced into many circles of society to their great improvement. For instance, the inhabitants of Cranford kept early hours.
And looking at this model, of the three models, there was an electric one, a mechanical one that could be played without electricity, and then a mechanical model with headphones. This model is apparently a mechanical one because it has a hand crank at the side. So you could turn that around enough times to operate a spring motor inside, And that would be enough to play one side up to 25 minutes of a talking book record. And this model also has a set of earphones, so a very, very early model. They're very thick. They're nothing like the thin earbuds you might have on an iPod or a portable listening device today. And that way, people could listen to these talking books at home and still have their privacy. There were some complaints in the early days about people overhearing, say, a romantic love scene in a book. And so this is one way a person can listen to anything they wanted at any time they wanted and not worry about offending family members in the room with them.
We have an extract here from St. Dunstan's Review. The speech from this box can be heard from a pair of earphones or by means of a special plug-in and a length of wire. It can be connected to your own wireless. And then it goes on to say, earphones are out of fashion, but my experience suggests to me that a good many blind people will use them for listening to talking books.
So I'm standing before one of the oldest surviving talking book records. It's a recording of Elizabeth Gaskell's 19th century novel, Cranford, and it's made by Anthony MacDonald. MacDonald made the first talking book ever recorded. We no longer have that recording, unfortunately, because a lot of these records were very fragile. The first talking books were made on 12-inch shellac discs. And in my pursuit of the early recordings, I've often come across fragments of the record. So these shellac material is very brittle and doesn't hold up for very long. So I've often found pieces of the record or the records have been lost altogether. This particular record's from 1936, and it's one of the oldest ones we still have.
Here amongst the archives, we have a formal memo, essentially a formal letter, issued by Ian Fraser in his capacity as chairman of the Sound Recording Committee. And in that, he provides an update on the clearly imminent release of the first five books. So he updates as follows. Records of five books are now being made. Others are being proceeded with, and by the end of September, we will be able to offer listeners a fair choice of books on a fair variety of subjects. Lord Nuffield's gift of £5,000 to the committee ensures a continued supply of new records for those who purchase machines, and in course of time, we hope to build up a widely comprehensive library. The five books now nearing completion are Henry Esmond by William Makepeace Thackeray, The Story of San Michele by Dr. Axel Munther, Typhoon by Joseph Conrad, Death in the Churchyard by William Gore, and The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie.
Now, there's some controversy about this. We've got a list of the first five books that were made. Do we know what one was first?
I've never been able to determine whether it was Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd or Joseph Conrad's Typhoon. They were the two earliest books recorded, but I can't determine which one actually was first. The Gospel of St. John's may have been the first recording because it was paid for by an outside group.
There's a list in one of Fraser's books, I guess, Whereas I Was Blind, that says the books on the list are not put forward as the best books, but these are reckoned the best under the conditions, and there are some serious pieces of writing on there.
Disraeli by André Maurois. Poetry. One side of the disc to be given to famous speeches from Shakespeare. The World Crisis by Winston Churchill. Chapter on Social Conditions in the 17th Century from History of England by Macaulay. Shakespeare by Sir Walter Raleigh.
And yet the books we have on that smaller list of five just all seem to be bestsellers.
Axel Munth lost his sight, didn't he? So yeah. I believe that, I mean, that would be an obvious connection. The others don't, as far as I know, have any particularly obvious choice other than that they would have been, I suppose, popular works.
Well, my sense is, in some ways, the decisions just match what were popular books at the time. So Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd was in the New Penguin paperback series too. So she was just a popular author being included in lots of series. So that's my sense of why they would choose her. It's a plot-driven story, so it's very easy to follow along. Conrad's slightly more surprising because even though he's often writing stories about storytellers, they're often very difficult to listen to, I find. But he did have a popular reputation at that time. He wasn't quite the highbrow author we think of him as today. But you're absolutely right then. The Story of San Michele was the one book chosen because of its relevance to blindness, because it had a blind author. The Gospel of St. John is a book that's almost always chosen first when books are made for a blind audience, whether in Braille or in recorded form, partly because it's got a scene of, I think, Jesus healing a blind man and raises a lot of sort of thematic issues about the relationship between blindness and sin or overcoming limitations and achieving spiritual salvation.
I've always heard that the first book was The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie, but I don't know where that came from. I don't know if it came from engineer to engineer. I've also heard one argument for Thackeray's Henry Esmond, but I think that was just because it's the first book on that list of five.
It's definitely not the first one, and they only recorded the first volume of it initially, because it's three volumes, a long Victorian novel. And Ian Fraser said it was too boring and they shouldn't spend more money recording the second and third volume. One of the early funders of the Talking Book Library was a group called the Pilgrim Trust, and they offered to pay the cost of recording serious literature. And initially, the NIB proposed recording, say, novels by Dickens or Walter Scott, good classic literature, but even that wasn't serious enough, so those titles were rejected. And instead, a bunch of nonfiction was recorded. So I think instead of recording a novel by Walter Scott, Scott's biography was recorded instead. And you have a lot of books from the 19th century on scientific topics or historical topics as well.
You're listening to the story of Ian Fraser and the first Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio. And we'll have more after this.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
A clip from Richard Baker's book, Here Is the News, recorded in 1967.
Much less frustrating is the experience of reading books for the blind. I'm one of a team of actors and broadcasters who make this one of their spare time occupations. In the tiny studio in Great Portland Street, we read for hours at a stretch into a microphone. The only visible audience, the sound engineer. The daughter of a blind lady of 80 wrote to me. The talking book machine, she said, has brought a renewal of joy and interest into her life, which is hard to describe. My mother sends her most warm thanks for bringing her so much pleasure and encouragement. Such a letter is immensely rewarding.
For more information on the Talking Book service, head to www.rnib.org.uk or call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999. And now a return to the story of the first Talking Books.
An interesting point about Talking Books is that of copyright. The instinct of authors and publishers was, of course, to let the blind have the use of their books just as freely as they've always allowed their works to be put into Braille. But whereas Braille is applicable only to the blind world, this new invention of the talking book might have a future, the extent of which could not at present be foreseen.
Initial decision was to record only books that were out of copyright, so let's say pre-20th century titles. But the Authors Association quickly agreed to allow these recordings to be made for blind people as long as they were carefully protected.
Eventually, great goodwill and generosity prevailed over doubts, and for a nominal fee, to put the matter on a legal basis and to confine its use to the blind only, permission is given for any book which we have wanted to record.
On the label of each of these early records, it says Sound Recording Committee, recorded solely for the use of the blind, and that was very important to make sure that no sighted people heard these records because they are protected by copyright. And on the label as well is a picture of a book that says Talking Books for the Blind across it, and behind it is sort of a cloud and a bright sunshine as if the book is being opened up to the viewer for the first time, and the light has dispelled the darkness.
So on the 7th of November 1935, the first talking books were sent to readers. Although many books were in production, only three books were available on that first day. Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, Joseph Conrad's Typhoon, and The Gospel According to St. John.
This is one of the rare instances of people with disabilities sort of receiving the benefits of the technology well before everyone else did. So the long-playing record did not become commercially available until about 1948. So blind people were using that technology, you know, over a decade before other people, and usually it's the other way around.
And as long as you were registered blind and had a turntable or received one through charity, you could join the Talking Book Library.
We're standing at 228 Great Portland Street, which is where the Talking Book Library first opened in 1935, but is now a block of flats. And it was a very unusual library. It wasn't like other libraries in that it was open to very few people. Its books were quite unique in that they were on records rather than on pages. And most of the patrons didn't actually come to the library. They received their books by post. So the Talking Books were recorded on a set of gramophone records, say 10 records per novel. They were sent out in a very sturdy container to blind people, to their homes, free of charge through the post, and then the blind person only had to pay the return postage to send the book back.
Although still officially in a trial period, the Talking Book was an immediate hit.
January the 11th, 1936. Dear Sir Ian, this is how I enjoy the Talking Book. Every night, at about 10 o'clock, I shoot the wife off to bed, then make up the fire, draw my armchair near, and after having got a bottle of Worthington and a cigarette going, I switch on the Talking Book. Don't you think this is real luxury? If the book is particularly interesting, it's possible I may have another disc and another Worthington, retiring to bed about midnight, taking care to replace disc in box and empties in proper place. I've only read two books and thoroughly enjoyed each. Not being able to sleep much and being very poor at Braille, you can imagine how useful the Talking Book is to me. Please thank those who have given me assistance and advice. They ought to have a monument three times the size of Nelson's. Yours truly, F.G. Braithwaite.
Although a huge success, the Talking Book had some dissenting voices. Many were from Braille readers who felt the service would take money from the production of new Braille books, but also from people who just didn't like some of the voices.
The American Talking Book Service in the UK won exchanged records for the next couple of decades. And in some ways that was great because it allowed them to expand their library. So I think at the end of the first year, end of 1935, they had about 55 books in the collection, half of which were made in the UK and half in America. So it was nice that the library was larger, but it also led to problems in terms of the accents that these books were recorded in. And you start to get a lot of complaints about, say, hearing Shakespeare in a Yankee twang. People seem to feel very strongly about readers of their books. So it's been very entertaining reading the complaints from people about narrators that they dislike hearing. So just as a good narrator can really make a mediocre book into something entertaining, a bad narrator can really ruin a book for people at the same time. So some of the letters I've come across include complaints such as one narrator made the flirtation between two young characters sound like the mooing of a frustrated old cow.
You get the distinct feeling from Ian Fraser's writings in 1936 that he felt that they should be probably going a bit more highbrow with the selection of titles. He goes on to mention here in St. Dunstan's Review, the great majority of the books in the library are, of course, light works of fiction of a popular kind. For instance, during the last 3 or 4 weeks, we have added John McNab by John Buchan, Bulldog Drummond at Bay by Sapper, The Scarlet Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi, and a very good travel and adventure story, Brazilian Adventure by Peter Fleming. The Talking Book is a very difficult thing to demonstrate. You cannot get a thoroughly good idea of the value of it by listening for a few minutes to a demonstration in a room with others present. The real value is made obvious only when you have the machine in your home and can listen to a few chapters of a book and get thoroughly into the story.
The library became incredibly popular, but by necessity was restricted to a limited number of members. Once again, Fraser approached Lord Nuffield, telling him, "You, in turn, after Louis Braille, have created a revolution in the blind world." Whether this was sincere or an attempt at flattery, it worked, and Lord Nuffield undertook to give Talking Books £5,000 a year for the next 7 years, and would donate a further £100,000 25 years later as the service moved to an early version of cassette tape. Talking Book suffered some setbacks during the Second World War, as both the studio and then its temporary replacement were bombed in the Blitz, and gramophone needles being sent by the American Foundation for the Blind due to a metal shortage were lost when the cargo ship carrying them was sunk by enemy action. After the war, though, the service resumed, with many more blind and partially sighted soldiers joining both NIB and St Dunstan's, although Fraser remained cautiously optimistic.
War is a great time for inventions, and the inventions called forth for the purpose of blowing property and human beings to pieces have a way of turning themselves to more agreeable and useful ends when peace returns. There was no time when inventions were more abundant than in the last war, and the technical progress which followed it afterwards was quite amazing. I have no doubt that this will occur again, and we shall keep sharp eyes on the lookout for any method which may enable us to improve the talking book.
More books were recorded, including, some years apart, both autobiographies by Ian Fraser, Whereas I Was Blind and My Story of St Dunstan's, both used to tell the story of talking books. Whereas I Was Blind was read by the BBC announcer Alvar Liddell, and My Story of St Dunstan's was read by Robin Holmes and was introduced by Fraser himself.
I happen to be the chairman of the Talking Book Board of Directors, and also was concerned with the early experiments in getting the talking book going. In this book, you'll read quite a few paragraphs about the talking book and its beginnings, and I think they may interest you.
That fledgling service with three books in its library has now delivered over 80 million books to blind or partially sighted listeners. Whether listened to on shellac or cassette, or Daisy CD or USB stick, or downloaded directly from RNIB Overdrive, no matter how you listen, you are realising Ian Fraser's dream. One of a book that could talk. The Talking Book service is now completely free, and although not available on shellac gramophone discs anymore, books are available in a format that should suit you, be it in Braille, in giant print, or in audio, on a Daisy CD, on a USB stick, or downloadable to your smart device via RNIB Overdrive. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk/books.
That's the end of track one. At the end of this announcement, move the control lever to off, remove the cassette, turn it over and replace it in the machine, then press the track change button once. Do this now.